So Keith Moon comes in, and he's always wasted, and he's in one of the in one of the high chairs, the high director's chairs. And at one point, he laughs and falls over backwards. Out of the chair falls whack on the floor. The whole room went silent. Everybody trying not to laugh. And his bodyguards quickly picked him up and dusted him off and set him back up in the chair.
Remember that voice from his days on American Top 40? Shadow Stevens talking about the legendary Keith Moon. Just one of many stories Shadow will share with us in just a few minutes. Welcome to Rob Bob Radio's Rock Conversations. I am Rob Bob, the self-proclaimed patriarch of rock and roll music. Self-proclaimed because no one else would give me the title. I may have allegedly stolen it or at least borrowed it, or maybe it was transferred to me, because I remember I had this friend when I was a freshman in college, Tom Biafor. He was a senior, and we went to see the Grateful Dead, and he had already nicknamed himself the patriarch of music. And he said, oh, you don't know the Dead. Man, we're going to get to the Dead. You're going to be turning to the patriarch and saying, what song is that? What song is that? Well, he did establish, and I knew the song as well. During that show, we marveled at how the fans behind us were just, they were just clamoring, great deal, great deal. And he turned to me and said, I don't know if they're referring to that version of the Dead song as a great deal or the transaction that took place in the parking lot. Shadow Stevens, as many of you know, was a host after Casey Kasem on American Top 40. Tough shoes to fill. But he did it. He did it for a number of years. But before that, and this is what we're going to talk to him about, before that, he helped establish and really revolutionize FM radio in Southern California, first with the world-famous K-Rock. It did not start out that way, K-R-O-Q, but Shadow had a lot to do with it, and it still reigns today as the world-famous K-Rock. He also worked with KMET, and if I'm not mistaken, KMET had a number of sister stations owned by Metro Media throughout the country in the 70s and even early 80s. And one of them was WMET in Chicago. When I think of WMET, I think of the Police album, Zenyatta Mandata, or as my childhood friend Mary Jo Sipo used to call it, Kenyatta Mandata, as if there was a compendium Barbie-yatta Mandata. But on the inner sleeve, there are a number of photos on Zenyatta Mandata, the Police album. And one of those photos includes Stuart Copeland with his feet kicked up on his drums, and he's wearing a WMET T-shirt. So that is why I often think of WMET, not to be confused with Shadow Stevens and KMET. His story about Keith Moon is just one of many he will share with us. Another great one involves Keith Moon and Ringo Starr. Imagine that. So it's time we commence to rocking and talking and our rock conversation with Shadow Stevens.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
So there was a station, K-Rock, K-R-O-Q, that hired you as a program director, if I'm not mistaken, about 1973. The station itself had kind of a rich history with the likes of Dr. Demento, Charles Laquadera, Tom Donahue. What was your vision when you were asked to take over programming what then had become K-Rock?
Well, I was coming to K-Rock from having had pretty surprising and profound kind of success at KRLA with an AM album music kind of approach. It was always very colorful and theatrical and bigger than life. You know, one of the first things it was the first time I'd ever been a program director, and I was, I think, 23 when I took over KRLA. And I immediately set about creating the world's largest jingle package. And I think we did about, 40 jingles. And when I was hired to go to K-Rock, they were a little AM station. And Gary Bucasta, who created the whole thing, built it. had this little AM station, but they had, you know, they were going to get an FM station, and they, and he said, and I would like you to take over when we get the FM station and do something really original. So they get the FM station, and then I go out to Pasadena and I create the studio and the format and even the logs and the layout of the room and all of the music. And it was all cutting edge music all the time. It was, we would concentrate on being the place that partied 24 hours a day. It would be all up, all rock all the time. And this was unheard of at that time because there was day partying, as you
sure
know.
Yep.
And that's the way radio worked, because the Little Housewives didn't want to give them too much rock during the middle of the day, you know, might shake them up. And so we will be partying. We will be playing, you know, Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and Iggy Pop, at 7 a.m. if we choose. Now, things were going really well. I hired Flo and Eddie, Mark Bowman and Howard Kalin from the Turtles, who were, had come off being with the Mothers of Invention, and so creative. And they came in, and I produced a Sunday night show called Flo and Eddie by the Fireside. And it became wildly successful. Ringo Starr showed up, and Keith Moon and just the who's who of entertainment and music. And
let me interject real quickly, if I could. What were those two like, especially? Were they together, Ringo and Keith, or separate?
They came in, actually, the night that we had Keith Moon, we had these high director's chairs, and everybody, and we had it was on Sunday night, and it was a big party. So it was Flo and Eddie, and they had their little director's chairs and their mics. And then I was at the board, and I would run it and produce it. And no song would ever go longer than 30 seconds. So it was this collage of mania and quite funny. And they're very funny people. And so we have Keith Moon in, and everybody's, you know, drinking tequila and smoking and talking. And we had everybody in the room were called the Mindless Dead. And so we would, you know, Mindless Dead, can we hear from you? And everybody would cheer. So Keith Moon comes in, and he's always wasted, and he's in one of the in one of the high chairs, the high director's chairs. And at one point, I mean, the room is packed. And at one point, he laughs and falls over backwards out of the chair, falls whack on the floor. The whole room went silent. Everybody trying not to laugh. And his bodyguards quickly picked him up and dusted him off and set him back up in the chair. And everyone came back to life. It was hilarious. Now, when we least expect it, with a room full of people and Keith Moon, Ringo Starr shows up, and he said, I just had to come and see where all this madness was coming from. And it went like that. We created this high energy station. It was very creative. Again, I did the giant Ah K Rock, Ah Mighty Rock with a huge, heavenly choir, and, you know, really over the top production and slowed down voices going K Rock, and it was very dramatic and very creative. But Gary wasn't able to sustain it financially. He kept trying to bring in money, and he would bring in people from the Grand Cayman Islands who would be, you know, hopefully investing, and we'd show them everything, and they'd go, oh, this is great, and then nothing would happen, and people's checks were bouncing, and everybody was going bankrupt. My car was repossessed out of my driveway in the middle of the night by burly Chinamen, and I was being driven from Topanga to Pasadena every day by the music librarian in his Volkswagen. And this is like unsustainable. Everybody was peeking on how creative and exciting it was. And at the same time, really suffering. And I couldn't take it anymore. So I resigned, and I handed in my resignation. And on hearing that, the entire staff resigned, and the station went off the air. And I was heartbroken, of course. All of these things come with extra stories, you know, that there's like nuance and detail that happens because it's all very difficult and really disappointing. And I vowed never to be in radio again.
That was it, huh?
And that was it. And so I started a production company, and I would trade out commercials for equipment. And little by little, I built up this little facility with my partner. And things were looking promising. And then I was offered this job to go to KMET. And a guy named L. David Moorhead was the general manager. And KMET had never really done anything. They'd been a kind of a quasi free form, you know, underground station that never got ratings. And he hired me, and he said, I want you to do something like you did at K-Rock, but, you know, maybe not quite so, you know, more like rock, album rock.
Well, it was such a unique time. I've always thought if I could go back in time. I was born in 69, so a little young by the mid-70s to appreciate it. But if ever I could go back to an era and experience, I think it would be the mid-70s and maybe in Southern California. Given the culture, you know, the rise of the singer-songwriters, as you say, the great radio stations. How did all that kind of come together for you as a program director? The music, the culture, the ability to be able to program this station, KMET, and really have it reflect the community? Because I found over years, not just from listening, but from being kind of a radio nerd, that these rock stations that were really successful became part of their communities. They weren't just music. They were personalities. They were creativity. They were part of the fabric, I'd like to say. And I'd like to get your thoughts on what it was like to be part of programming, to be the programmer of KMET, and how that all came together and in a very short time as well, I might add.
Well, again, you know, it was because I didn't know any life other than being in radio because I'd built a radio station in my house when I was 10, and I was hired on a local station at 11 and worked through high school and then through 5 years of college at the University of North Dakota and then the University of Arizona. And I was off and running. So by the time I got to Boston and we had huge ratings in Boston, we had 33% of the entire audience. And on that, I was brought to LA, and then I was also given a chance to do some television. So a lot of things happened that were all very exciting and all kind of aligned with, you know, being in entertainment and doing what I wanted to do. Being made a program director of a major Los Angeles radio station in my early 20s was, I didn't apply for it. I just went to the general manager after I'd been hired there. And I said, we need to be playing this music that everyone is listening to. You know, it's like, it's not enough to play just top 40 music like KHJ. We have to have, you know, we have to have some depth. We have to, you know, like there's no reason not to be playing all this music. And he was so impressed by my research that he fired the program director and made me program director. It's like, what? No, I'm going to Art Center School at night, you know, studying art, and I'm happy being a disc jockey, and everything is fine. And all of a sudden, he's given me this big position, and I had to figure out what worked, you know, what about radio is interesting? What is magic? You know, what is the character? Now, there's no social media at the time. We were the social media. We were the people that talked about what's going on in the world and in music and in television and movies and in the community, like you say, you know, what's happening in Southern California, the most exciting place in the world. And so it was like one thing after another. So it was KRLA, and then K-Rock made this big statement and then crashed. And then I went to KMET, and none of that ever went simple either. Everything in life is 1,000 times harder than it seems like it should ever be. But it was challenge upon challenge upon challenge. And so I go in and create a similar kind of thing with a big production. Now, by this time, I had my own production studio, so I could do a lot of my productions at home. And we put on really creative promotions that included, you know, having major rock stars take over an hour of as a disc jockey. Every hour, there's a different one all weekend long. And so huge personalities came in and did it.
You have a favorite memory or two from the rock stars coming in? One or two stick out?
You know, one of my favorite memories, it doesn't have to do with that, because I can't quite remember all of them, but they were pretty impressive. But I was on the air and with Brother John, one of my favorite people of my whole life. And John was really creative and really funny. And we were celebrating Shakespeare's birthday. And we were doing it all in that in mock Shakespearean voice. You know? So we there before. And for some reason, we were just clicking that day. And it was very funny. And I'm in there smoking a joint and buzzed and having a great time. And there's a knock on the door. And I go to the door, and it's David Bowie. And he's and David Bowie and a friend. And they said, I just had to come and see where all of this madness is coming from. It's like, now, normally, you know, I prepare. If I'm going to have a guest, I'm going to have my thoughts in order. I know what I'm going to do, what I'm going to suggest. You know, I want to talk, we want to interview. I'm, you know, I loved David Bowie. And we, in fact, I was one of the first people in America to play David Bowie at KRLA. I had a friend in England who said, you got to play this guy. I'm going to send you the records. And they did. And then we started playing it and became like an early advocate for David Bowie. And then at K-Rock, of course, he was like a centerpiece as
sure.
Well as
yep.
Queen. We were some of the first people to play Queen. Queen was the sound of K-Rock in its early days. And there's David Bowie, who I idolized. Come on in. Yeah. Have a seat. So you want to go on the air? You want to? And he says, no, I just wanted to see what's happening. Now, this, it had the worst studios, maybe in all of a big time radio. It was closet sized. And there was a little window in front where an engineer would put in the commercials. Nothing else. I would play the music on the turntables or on tapes and cue the engineer for reasons I can't understand. He had to like cue the commercials. So I'm looking through this little window and the guy in there is going, I can't believe this is happening. And I know. And it's like, I'm playing music and I'm playing Bonzo Dog and, you know, like really wacky stuff and the Kinks and things that he loved. And I kind of don't know how to handle it. And
you're a little stoned at the time too, right?
And yeah, I'm wasted. No, and just this year, where is this book? This book came out. And in it, he talks about going to this disc jockey named Shadow with David Bowie. And he tells the whole story. He gets it wrong, but he tells the story and the essence of it is true. They did show up. It really was weird. I was blown away. But he remembered it as being like 5 a.m. or something. And no, it wasn't. It was the mid-afternoon. And there were key things that Dylan Jones got wrong. But it validated me because I was like, nobody remembers this but me. But David Bowie did come. And that is like gotten from David Bowie, that gold record for all those albums. And it was signed by
him.
That's
awesome.
He said, so I have a gift for you. I go, what? And he hands me this little wrapped gift and I unwrap it. And it is a book. And it's like a soft cover book with a felt cover over it. And the felt cover had an inscription from him that said, to Shadow from Bowie. And the complete works of Shakespeare, it says on it. And I opened it up, and it was the works of Chairman Mao. I went, that's the greatest joke I've ever, I still have the book. So I should put it under glass somewhere, you know, with a little spotlight and a rope.
Absolutely, you should. Yeah. So you alluded to it a little bit, you know, having a friend in England introduce you to music, whether it was Queen or Bowie. You talked about getting hired because of your quote unquote research. So I'm curious to know, before you were hired as the program director at KMET, what sort of research were you doing and how were you able to select the music? Was it a matter of talking with friends and finding out what they were listening to, going to the local record store and seeing what was selling, or was it a more formal approach?
Well, personally, I was always passionate about music and did my own research, but I set up every station that I worked for with somebody who was in charge of going through and meeting with all the record companies, all of the record promoters, and find out the best of the best. And it was, even if you just think it's worth considering, we would consider it. And every week we would have a music meeting with the whole staff. And it would be, all of the personalities had to be there, and everybody would have their little sheets with all of the recommended songs, and we would listen to them, and we would vote, and we would vote on things that were being played, like, is this being played too much? Maybe we should push this a little more. Is everybody like this? This is kind of becomes the sound of KMET or the sound of K-Rock, and so we would play that a little bit more, and still have all of this new music to be playing and talking about. And then there would be information about the artists and you know, where they came from and excuse me, and things that they could use on the air. So it was a real kind of democratic, organized approach to getting a lot of people who were all skilled radio people with a lot of experience. And what do we decide together? And that was it. There wasn't like you bring in your own, you know, music from home, because we wanted to have a consistent sound that was, that had a certain structure to it. It wasn't just free form. I feel like blues today. We wanted to have something that served the listeners. And it was very flexible. I mean, we were playing a lot of things that people we go like, who?
So I was going to ask you, in addition, I mean, you mentioned Bowie and Queen. So whether it was K-Rock or KMET, are there a few other artists that you discovered and helped showcase? You broke them, in other words, that really stand out and you're proud of?
Oh, well, at K-Rock, it was, you know, all of the punk, you know, because we were pre-punk at the beginning.
Sure. Yeah.
And then it became, and that's when Rodney Bingenheimer came in. Rodney was, on the Flo and Eddie show on Flo and Eddie by the Fireside. And Rodney would come in, and he was our Glitter correspondent, because Glitter was popular before punk. And he knew all the Glitter artists, and he was always into the new music. And so he was a great guest, who was a terrible disc jockey, but had something about him because he was so passionate about the music, and he would discover people, and he had really good taste. So he would come in with, you know, flamboyant, you know, would-be artists or breakthrough artists. And then later on, when I went back to K-Rock, after KMET, I went back to K-Rock and consulted. And my deal was, I knew that they didn't have any money, and I knew that I wouldn't have any control, and I knew that people would do kind of what they want to do. So I said, I'll just consult. I'll do my best to give it a structure, and I will do weekend shows myself, and I will sell all of the commercials and keep all the money. And they said, okay. So I did that through the end of the 70s. I'd go in every Saturday and Sunday and do these shows and sell all the commercials. And they were all commercials I was doing in my studio and keeping all the money. But again, it was the worst studios in the history of the world. And I would have to bring in my own equipment to have it sound halfway decent. It just got to be too much. But during that time, there were a couple of things that we did. One was put in Rodney on the Rock, and Hollywood Night Shift with Frazier Smith. And Frazier would come in every week, and he would do this wildly creative, you know, very funny show. And that those became staples that lasted after I left. And by the end of the 70s, like late 79, I couldn't take it anymore, and I quit. And went, okay, I guess that's it. I'm done with radio forever.
Yeah. You kind of stuck to that, didn't you?
But it kind of drew me back.
So I want to be respectful of your time. In the few minutes we have left, let's do some rapid fire if we could. What gave you the idea for the Upside Down Billboard, KMET?
The Upside Down Billboard, I can't show it to you, but the first billboard we did was called Hollywood as Seen from Mulholland Drive in the year 2525. And I hired my and my advisor when I was an art major was this brilliant, and he's still alive in his 90s, Robert Nelson. And he designed this kind of metropolis looking Hollywood of the future. And it was very cool. And it became a whole billboard, and it said Quad KMET. It was very dramatic. And then that was so, you know, so over the top. We wanted to do something simple. And I said, let's just do block fluorescent letters upside down. And he says, if they're upside down, you won't be able to read them. And I said, and your point? He says, they'll talk about it. And so I had to fight for it. And then he went, oh, okay, well, we'll try it. And it was one of those things like, what? And then it became a staple. The other thing that happened during that era was on my show, I was interviewing the Pointer Sisters. And I said, would you sing a jingle for me? And they said, sure, you got one. And I said, I just happened to have written this driving into work today. And I jotted it down. I showed them my scribbles. And it said, a little bit of heaven, 94.7, KMET, Tweedledee. They went, oh, I love that. And they sang it once live, and they used it for the next 10 years.
A little bit of heaven, 94.7 KMET, Tweedledee.
And that's awesome. That's awesome.
Upside Down Billboard and A Little Bit of Heaven were the two things that really outlived me, because I was only there a little over a year. But it was a really dramatic year where it got the highest ratings in Los Angeles, period. I still have them because I knew at the time that if I left, no one would remember how well it did. And it was record-breaking. It was really phenomenal. And it had Harry Shearer on the weekends and a blues show on Sundays. And we did a radio theater show called The Great American Countdown.
Well, speaking of radio theater, how's this for a cheesy segue, huh? You've got this project going, Mental Radio, which is, I'll let you describe it. You can obviously do that much better than I.
Well, Mental Radio is described as audio theater on jet fuel. I wanted to create, when the pandemic started, I knew I had my studio. I knew I'm going to be here in a long time. What do I want to do? And it doesn't matter if I make money. I want to do something that is uplifting and funny. And so I started writing all of this stuff and gave it a whole mythology. It's a whole backstory. And the story is that Mental Radio goes back to Nikola Tesla in 1893, when he came up with wireless energy transfer. And he realized that was not only that he could supply energy to the entire world, but that it also went beyond the physical realm into the subconscious. And he realized this is too far out. So he had to form a secret society that would be dedicated to uplifting mankind. And all these people became members of this secret society of Optimisticals. That's optimistic, like M-Y-S-T-I-C-A-L-S. And to this day, it's a growing, ever-growing organization of people who were always there when the world needed it. And now I've got this kind of Mercury Theater team of people that that are participating and contributing, and a terrific website that was built for me by a guy who said, I want in, I'll help. And
that's mentalradio.net.
Mentalradio.net.
Yep. Let's throw that in there.
And the, and then there's an app for both Apple and Android, and it's free. And it'll give you access to everything that we've done. And there's now 17 chapters, 17 half hour shows. And it includes, and it's all about the mind. It's all an allegory. It's all about getting ahead of the mind, getting behind the mind, get ahead of the mind with activity and thoughts and things that you can do and mindset and making fun of being afraid, and getting behind the mind with meditation. I talk about meditation in the shows and give 90-second introductions to the experience of meditation, where you go from a rattled mind to a calm state in just 90 seconds. And each one is original music and gongs and chimes and tones that have been used for thousands of years to quiet the nervous system. And then it goes back to being really funny. And some of the people I have working for me are really fabulous. I'll write things. I've got this co-writer, Joshua Weinstein, who's come in and is now writing everything with me. And he's a wonderful screenplay writer. And we'll write these things and then send them out to different people to do different voices. And sometimes when I get them, I just go, oh my God, it's so good. It's so funny. And I can't wait to start putting it together. And then it all sounds like it's all like really happening. Making up the sounds, using the music, always, you know, with a point of view of making some kind of a statement. And I call it subversive optimism, because it's optimism disguised as humor. And the idea is to leave you a little brighter and a little more empowered than when you started. I just say, give it 5 minutes. Just put on headphones, just download the app, it's free. Put on headphones, listen to the first 5 minutes of anything. And I think you'll find it's not like anything you've ever heard before. It's quite funny, and it has a lot of depth to it.
You mentioned the app. The website is mentalradio.net. This has been great. There's so much to cover, and maybe we can do it again sometime, because I have a list of questions that I didn't get to. But
of course,
yeah, this has been it's been fun. It's been entertaining, and I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.